Iowa's first year of legal fireworks since the 1930s resulted in a big increase in related injuries. This hour, we'll hear from a surgeon who treated some of those victims. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, I'll talk with an Iowa native now living in the midst of the California wildfires. Dean Borg has an update on ISU's presidential search. Also, are so-called high-intensity workouts sending the wrong message? And how will President Trump's withdrawal from UNESCO impact our country's only UNESCO-designated city of literature, Iowa City? Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week about some news that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk show week. Coming up a little bit in a few minutes, I'll talk with an Iowa native, a native of Cedar Falls, as a matter of fact, now living in the midst of those Northern California wildfires. Dean Borg will be along with an update on Iowa State University's presidential search. Do you do these so-called HIIT workouts, high-intensity workouts? A new study from ISU about those. Also, how will President Trump's withdrawal from UNESCO impact our country's only UNESCO-designated city of literature? Yes, Iowa City is that city. That coming up in just a moment. But first, this week, animal rights and free speech organizations filed a lawsuit against the state of Iowa. It challenges our state's law from 2012 that made it illegal to get a job at a livestock farm through misrepresentation in order to conduct an animal cruelty undercover investigation, for example. The groups claim Iowa's law violates their constitutional free speech and equal protection rights. These laws are sometimes called ag-gag laws or ag-whistleblower laws. Now, it's important to note that federal courts have struck down similar laws in the states of Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah. So let's talk with a legal expert from one of those states in the hopes of getting an idea of how this new Iowa lawsuit will fare. Erica George is the Samuel D. Thurman Professor of Law at the University of Utah. Erica George, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Now, back in July, I understand a federal judge ruled that Utah's ban on this secret filming of farms and slaughterhouse operation unconstitutional. What were the arguments on each side, and why did the court decide the way it did?
That's correct. And from your opening segment, Utah's law was quite similar to Iowa's, in fact, perhaps even more expansive. Our law followed yours by a few months, and we had four provisions here in Utah. One was a lying provision, and then there were three recording provisions. So essentially, our law made it illegal, like Iowa's, to obtain access to an agricultural operation under false pretenses. So that could be lying on a job application and getting employed, or lying to get access or somehow visit a farm. And then once there, filming or recording what went on the farm. So our court determined that that kind of activity was protectable by the First Amendment. So if a state is going to make legislation that's going to run afoul of protected speech, then courts have to look at it very closely and balance the state interests against the public interest for access to information.
Mm-hmm. So what part, you mentioned lying, recording, I've heard trespassing also mentioned in these kinds of course cases. So what is the crux of the free speech argument that the ones who were successful in Utah made here?
Okay. Well, the crux of the argument is essentially that lying isn't categorically unprotected by the First Amendment. Only those lies that cause a legally cognizable harm. So, for example, a restaurant reviewer might be undercover to access a restaurant and order off the menu. That'd be very different than lying to get business trade secrets, for example. So There's some courts that have ruled on this, and specifically on the types of harms that tort and lying are trying to protect against, but that essentially is interference with ownership or possession of land. So where someone's entering a property and not disrupting what's going on the property, that's protected kind of conduct where they're seeking to record and share and disseminate information.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it's one thing to storm a farm and save a cow or a chicken. It's quite another to stand and record and share what the conditions of production are. And that's more of what's been the conduct that's been engaged by animal rights activists and free speech advocates when engaged in this kind of activity.
Right. So if I'm recalling a case here in Iowa, one of these activists got into a farm for hens where the little chicks are born, and the male chicks are useless in an egg-laying operation. So I guess the film there, tough to watch. That's how we get our eggs. The little male chicks were just fed buckets full of them into a grinder, for instance. And you had similar things happening in Utah?
Well, the facts that gave rise to this lawsuit, there was a young woman who was standing not in the farm property but alongside it on public land, filming into it, and recorded a cow that was injured and in really pretty bad shape. So she documented the animal abuse, was arrested, charged, and later charges were dismissed because she actually hadn't entered the property, which is part of the Utah law.
Mm-hmm.
So on those facts, this elevated to a direct challenge to the constitutionality of the law itself. And the concern is that this is really capturing too much of the kind of speech conduct that we want to protect in the broader, larger interests of access to information for consumers, for the general public. So while there are interests that are being balanced with respect to private property rights and the agricultural industry's interest in being able to conduct and do business, when the intent of a state body trying to regulate is really to repress or censor or stop the dissemination of information, courts are going to look more closely and be concerned. And that was the concern of the Utah court, looking at the intent behind this kind of speech repression.
In 30 seconds, Erica George, based on your knowledge of the Utah case that was successful in striking down this law and what you know of Iowa, what can you say about Iowa's case law? Will it be struck down as well, do you suppose?
To the extent that it stands similar to Utah's law in criminalizing the kind of an undercover investigative conduct that routinely journalists, whistleblowers, and activists engage in, I think it's on shaky ground. I haven't looked at the direct text of what's being prohibited in Iowa, but judging by what other courts have done, this certainly seems that the state should be proceeding with caution, and
okay.
I'd be concerned.
Thank you. Erica George, at the University of Professor of Law at the University of Utah. Thank you, Erica.
And thank you very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the misery caused by one of the deadliest wildfire outbreaks in California's history, it's not over, not by a long shot, according to officials there. The fires in Northern California have killed at least 31 people as of this morning. It makes it one of the deadliest series of fires ever in the state of California. Joining us now, Charity Anderson. Charity is a Cedar Falls native who has for several years lived in California, actually living in the town of Windsor. That's about 7 miles north of Santa Rosa, where the original fires broke out. Hi, Charity.
Hello.
Tell us, what is your situation now? How close are the fires to your home?
Well, right now the fires are still still very active in Santa Rosa, which is about 7 miles from here. There is a finger of the Tubbs fire that is about a mile and a half from our house in Windsor, on the outskirts of Windsor in Shiloh Regional Park. That has the town of Windsor, the east side of Windsor, on an evacuation advisory, which is not mandatory, but it's basically an advisory to have your belongings ready to go in the event that anything changes.
Mm-hmm.
They do have that controlled at the moment. So as of yesterday, we've been feeling a lot better about that particular fire.
And calmer winds, we hope?
Yesterday was much calmer winds, but there is a red flag warning issued for this evening into tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So while we felt like we had a little bit of a reprieve yesterday, I think people are starting to get a little more on edge after that warning was issued.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you must be on edge. What have the last few days been like?
Well, you know, my husband and I were actually in Portland until Sunday night, and we got back Sunday night, went to bed like normal, and then at 4:30 in the morning, I got a phone call from a recorded message from the school saying that all of the School of Windsor was closed due to the fires. So I had no idea what was going on. I went outside my front door, and just as you looked across the way to the trees, the entire sky was red. And so at that point, I started looking, getting on the computer, but we didn't have any internet access. My phone was kind of spotty, so I wasn't able to even, you know, get on the internet with my phone. Fortunately, I had a radio, and so I turned on the radio and started getting the news, and that's when we learned that this very fast-moving fire was moving through Santa Rosa at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been scary.
Have friends, family, acquaintances, anybody you know been affected? Had a house burned down or worse?
Oh, yeah. I have, just as the days roll on, I keep finding out more personal friends, acquaintances that have lost their homes. You know, one of the boys in our Cub Scout pack lost his home, a yoga teacher, a first grade teacher at our kids' school. So we just keep getting more and more information. I haven't known anybody personally that has lost their life, but it was quite an experience to listen to the names being read off yesterday at the press conference in the evening.
Right. And this idea that you can be in your house and all of a sudden you've got flames on all sides and you're unable to escape. You may be in a car, you may be in a house. That's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And the winds were so bad on Sunday night when we got home. I can only imagine, you know, that was what made that fire so bad. And so that's, you know, why people didn't have the notice that they needed to get out quick enough or grab any of their belongings. What I've heard is, you know, officers and neighbors were just banging on each other's doors trying to get people out in time.
Right. Before we say goodbye, Charity, I'm just wondering, to boil down a household into a few items that you can move very quickly out, you have those by the door? Do you have bags packed?
Our bags have been packed and in the car since Monday morning at 6 o'clock.
Was it hard to choose what you take and what you leave behind?
You know what? For me, it wasn't. I just packed a few clothes for each of the kids and myself and my husband. We got our birth certificates, our social security cards, some pictures, some thumb drives that have pictures on them, and our computer. And that was it for us. I know I have friends that are packing up much more in their cars, but for us, we just felt like that was what we were going to take.
Okay. Charity Anderson, a native of Cedar Falls, Iowa, who now lives close to the wildfires. You heard it, just a mile or so away from her home in Windsor, a town about 7 miles north of Santa Rosa. And we wish you and your family well. Charity, be safe.
Thank you so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While the search continues for the next president of Iowa State University, Iowa State University has four finalists in the state this week visiting as part of its search for their next president. Bringing us up to date on that, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
Introduce us to these four candidates, please.
Well, they range in age, Ben, from 54 up to 65. The 65-year-old, the eldest, is Sonny Ramaswamy. He's currently a political appointee completing a six-year term at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, appointed there by President Obama, but that term ends next May, so he's going to be out of a job, and he's looking for one right now. He's formerly been at Oregon State, Purdue, Kansas State, and Kansas universities. And then the second candidate, Pamela Whitten, currently provost and senior vice president at the University of Georgia. Interestingly, Ben, last year at this time, she was interviewing for the top job at the University of Tennessee. She's at Iowa State now, trying her luck, and she's 54 years old. Dale Whitaker was the third candidate to be interviewed. He's 56-year-old. His background is in agricultural engineering, degrees from Texas A&M and Purdue, and he's currently the executive vice president at Central Florida University, and he was at Purdue before that. And then Wendy Winterstein, she's 61 years old. She's currently the dean of Iowa State's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. So she's a home campus person.
Mm-hmm. What are the differences when you've attended these community talks with the hiring committee included between the candidates that jumped out at you?
Well, every one of them was, they had a common theme that they were supposed to address. The public forums were, first of all, about a 20 to 30 minute speech, and then questions after that to complete an hour forum. And all of them were given a common theme: what is the next step for Iowa State to go up the ladder, and how do we get there? That I'm paraphrasing, but that's what the idea was. Well, they all took different approaches to that, but I thought it interesting, Ben, that every one of them mentioned in their presentation that Iowa State needs to improve its graduation rate for undergraduates. Less than 50% now graduate within 4 years. And so every one of them mentioned that. Now, one thing I'd like to point out, these interviews were live streamed. And so
is that perhaps a first?
It may have been. I can't recall that they've been live streamed in the past. But I happen to think, what about the three other candidates who watched the first one and then the two other candidates watching the second one?
They had an advantage.
They had an advantage because many of the questions were similar from the forum audience.
Mm-hmm.
The audiences varied, Ben. Sunny Ramaswamy had a moderately full great hall at the Memorial Union at Iowa State, and the audiences went down for Pamela Whitten and Dale Whitaker, but it was, as far as I could tell, standing room only for Wendy Winterstein, the home campus candidate.
Were there any difference that you could see in this public forum between the concerns of the community and the hiring committee?
No, I think that the word is transparency. Let us know what you're doing. And many of the questions concerned also are, let us know what you're doing, but also please collaborate with us. Students were saying that a minority representation on the university campus asked for greater collaboration with them. The Story County supervisor who spoke at every one of them asked for collaboration and what would you do for collaboration. So those two themes came out. I will say, Ben, interestingly, Wendy Winterstein, we've spoken about her as the home campus candidate, she really leveraged that factor in her background. She's been 40 years at Iowa State, mm-hmm. and she was not shy at all about yesterday in her presentation saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she came on introducing this subject by talking about traveling around with former President Greg Joffre around the state of Iowa appearances. And she said when he would introduce me, he would always cite my administrative ability and that I was a presidential timber. I'm using that word, but that she had presidential qualifications. Then she went into, so I'm qualified. I know the challenges. Iowa State has big challenges now, and she outlined those. I know the people. I know the nuances. Why should we spend time getting another person up to speed as president? Mm. I'm here and ready to go.
Now, we've been, of course, in our news, and you've been reporting on it too. All of our public universities in Iowa have been grappling with funding declines and questions of how much tuition has to rise in order to meet the revenue that they're needed. Was that addressed as well?
Well, interestingly there, one of the candidates, Pamela Whitten, she's currently the provost and senior vice president at the University of Georgia, she said, as I look at your tuition, you haven't got anything to complain about. Yours is amazingly low compared to what it is elsewhere.
Okay. All a matter of relativity, I guess.
And what she said too, Ben, and this could prepare if she's appointed, she said, one thing we have to do is not be looking all the time for new money. We need to pare away those things that we have become accustomed to at our universities and no longer have a shelf life.
Mm, interesting. I have to ask you about the process here because, of course, the process of selecting a president is in a spotlight given the hiring of now University of Iowa president for 2 years, Bruce Harreld, the former corporate executive here. Of course, that's still under harsh scrutiny. In fact, a lawsuit still pending there. But did you see a real emphasis in, you mentioned transparency, that had to be a part of an emphasis in the process?
Well, this has been a very open process. I don't mean that the public has been invited in so far. This has been, with these four finalists, the first time the president, the public has gotten a chance to see who are candidates. But the finalists have been selected by a 21-member presidential search committee. They've been working since May. And now, just this week, one by one, the candidates, the last four that they've identified as finalists, have been identified. Now, in this 21-member search committee, there are four members of the Board of Regents on that search committee, as well as faculty and staff from Iowa State and members of the general public around Iowa, also on that 21-member search committee. That search committee has identified the four finalists that I just spoke of and we've been talking about, and now that search committee will come and meet with the Board of Regents and give their findings so far and also things that came out during the public forums. And then the Board of Regents takes over now, and they will then interview themselves in private, the four finalists, and they'll make a selection on October 23rd.
Before we spoke, and in closing here, Dean, you mentioned that of the four candidates, two of them are bug specialists.
Yes.
Now, what does bug entomology have to do with leading a public university?
Well, I thought a lot about that. Sonny Ranasamy, who was at the USDA, and Wendy Winterstein, who is the campus dean of agriculture right now, both of them are entomologists in their academic specialties. Pamela Whitten, she has a communication studies major, and Dale Whitaker is an ag engineer. But as you say, Winterstein and Ramaswamy, both entomologists, your question was, what's that got to do with leading a university? Well, I think what it shows is, no matter where you start out in your academic career, that with administrative ability, you progress up into administration and maybe the presidency.
Okay. Never bugging us with his analysis, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Thanks. And sorry about that last joke.
Enjoyed it, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, Iowa's first year of legal fireworks since the 1930s resulted in a big increase in injuries. In just a moment, we'll hear from a surgeon who treated some of the victims. Also, how will President Trump's withdrawal from UNESCO impact our country's only UNESCO-designated city of literature, which happens to be, yes, Iowa City? We'll talk about that with Chris Merrill in our second half hour. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quick conversations to end the week. I'm Ben Kiefer. Please stay with us.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're midstream in this news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we heard in the news this week, Iowa's first year of legal fireworks since the 1930s resulted in a big increase in related injuries. Well, let's spend a few minutes talking with an Iowa trauma surgeon who dealt with the consequences. She's also an author of a review that the University of Iowa put together to assess trends in emergency medicine department visits to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics before and after the implementation of our new fireworks law. We're joined by Dr. Kathleen Romanowski, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. Dr. Romanowski, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You were on call July 1st through the 4th, I see in my notes. Before we talk about your firsthand experience, tell us about the findings of your review, what you looked at and what you found.
So we looked at data from the previous 3 years during the legalization period only, so June 1st through July 8th in those previous years, and then June 1st through July 8th of this year. And we found pretty startling increase in the number of patients who sustained fireworks injuries during that time. In the year prior, it had been 10 patients, and it jumped up to 21 patients this year, which represents a 210% increase over the previous year.
Okay, so, and you looked at certain groups, minors, bystanders, people not necessarily firing the fireworks, right?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So we looked at, there was a 3.8 times increase in the number of bystanders who were injured. And perhaps most alarmingly, there was a not only an increase in the number of minors who were injured, but also a trend towards them becoming firework handlers rather than bystanders.
Mm, okay, so younger people handling fireworks, perhaps encouraged by this legalization?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk. But you are, as I mentioned, a trauma surgeon. You were on call. You had to deal with a number of the injuries. What did you see? Give us a specific of specific instances here of the injuries.
We saw a wide range of things. We saw eye injuries, multiple eye injuries, some quite severe requiring operations.
Anybody lose their sight?
It was still it's still probably an ongoing question as to what the sight will be in at least one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some pretty bad soft tissue injuries that required skin grafts, some fractures requiring operations, and in one case, even like a traumatic brain bleed.
Traumatic, a hemorrhage in the brain?
Correct.
And that was caused by some sort of blast?
It was from a blast effect, yes, from a firework.
Mm-hmm. I read, and I don't know if you dealt with this one, an explosion in a mother's lap while she was holding an infant?
Yes, she's one of my patients. I've taken care of her on that occasion and then in some of her subsequent hospital stays.
How much can you tell us about what was what were the circumstances that led to that?
I know this one has definitely been in the news. And so she was, again, one of our bystanders who was injured and was with her family at a fireworks show when a firework misfired and came at her.
Okay, so yeah, so we legalized Class 1 and Class 2 fireworks with our new law. So firecrackers, rockets, Roman candles, and the like, they're,
mm-hmm.
They're to may be used between June 1st and July 8th. So from your perspective, were most of these cases poor judgment, misuse, faulty fireworks, just plain bad luck?
I think it's a real combination. I think there is probably a certain number that are mishandling. And poor judgment. And there's, certainly a number that were people who had tried to put safety plans into place and either had misfirings or things knocked over or, fireworks are unpredictable.
Right.
And so there's a certain number that are unpredictability and there's a certain number that are bad judgment.
Mm-hmm. So very quickly before we go, I guess just to forecast this into the future, I mean, we may be in a transition period, I guess is my thought. Are these injuries, this uptick in injuries, is that avoidable if people are more careful, more aware? Or do we have to just reckon that now in a state with these type of legal fireworks, we will have these injuries?
I think mostly the latter. So I think you know, fireworks are unpredictable. And so I think as careful as you can be, there's going to be instances where people get hurt. And if we're allowing more fireworks and larger fireworks, there's going to be more serious injuries, I believe, that we're going to encounter. Certainly education on proper handling, on proper distance for bystanders to be away, trying to target keeping them out of the hands of children. A lot of these can go to decreasing the enormous surge we saw this year, but I think some of it is unavoidable just because of the unpredictable nature of explosive devices.
Dr. Kathleen Romanowski, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Romanowski, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Hey, wouldn't it be great to exercise really intensely, because we're all on these crammed in schedules, to go all out for as little as 1 minute and then have it count for our bodies to be the benefits of a 45 or 60 minute workout? That's sort of the idea behind and also the allure of what is called high intensity interval training, also known as HIIT. It's a new study conducted at Iowa State University says these high-intensity workouts send the wrong message. Patty A.K. Kakis is with us. He is a kinesiology professor at Iowa State University in on this study, an expert on exercise psychology. Patty, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to reveal my bias. I did a HIIT workout earlier this year. I thoroughly failed to appreciate it. but tell us, these are high intensity workouts. They've become all the rage in the last few years. What does your study look at?
So what we try to investigate is primarily the sustainability, the potential for this type of exercise to become your regular exercise routine, and then the potential for people, average people, to stick to a regimen of that sort. So our primary focus was on the immediate pleasure versus displeasure experiences that average non-athletic adults derive from that type of exercise and the amount of enjoyment that they report.
And what did you find as pertaining to high-intensity interval training?
We specifically recruited women who had been sedentary for at least 1 year, but in several cases sedentary for decades, but were interested in returning and becoming active again. And we had them exercise at two intensities that resulted in the same number of calories expended. One was your more traditional moderate intensity prolonged exercise that lasted for 30 minutes. And then the other was a modified version of the high-intensity interval format. And I say modified, the main modification was that we could not get these women to go to 100% because we were concerned, you know, for safety reasons. So we scaled back the intensity a little bit, but it was still vigorous. And that lasted for about 25 minutes. So we had a five-minute savings at the end.
Cutting to the chase in the interest of time, tell us, what were the conclusions that you need to, you're an expert on the exercise psychology. It's not enough to just have exercise. You have to enjoy it. And that's not really the intent on these types of trainings?
Correct. So it was hard enough to get, you know, women in that category to feel good with exercise of any sort, and definitely the high-intensity interval format made them feel even worse. Mm-hmm. So it goes against human nature to expect that people will voluntarily want to expose themselves to that type of exercise again and again and again on a regular schedule. So that's our concern, that trying to convince people who are currently sedentary that this is the way to go, I think perpetuates this understanding that exercise has to be unpleasant. And if it is unpleasant, we are concerned that it is not going to be sustainable.
Mm, there's a good message. So find something to exercise that you love to do, that you enjoy. That is the way to do it. Maybe it's high intensity interval training, but for a lot of people, maybe not. Thank you very much, Patty A.K. Kakis, kinesiology professor at Iowa State University. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, the U.S. and Israel announced they were Leaving the UN's cultural agency, known as UNESCO, comes after Washington accused it of anti-Israeli bias. The withdrawal of the U.S. is a major blow for this Paris-based organization. It was founded after World War II to help protect cultural and natural heritage around the world. Well, for some local reaction from a notable Iowan, very much connected to UNESCO, let's turn to Christopher Merrill in our studio, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. He serves on the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO. Also in 2012, President Obama appointed him to the National Council on the Humanities. Chris Merrill, welcome back to our program. Let's just start out. Not good news, I know, for you and for UNESCO, for what you're doing. What's your reaction?
It's a terrible decision that the Trump administration has made, and it follows on several years of the United States not paying its dues to UNESCO. So in addition to isolating us from the rest of the world, we've also pulled the ultimate grifter move. We owe UNESCO hundreds of millions of dollars in back dues. This dates back to a decision made to withdraw funding for UNESCO because the Palestinian Authority had sought to be admitted into the body, and a law dating from the early 1990s made it incumbent upon the administration of the Obama administration to withdraw from UNESCO because that decision was made. So we're seeing the kind of the last hurrah here. The problem is that it's more than just a cultural organization. Yes, Iowa City belongs to the UNESCO Creative Cities Network, a vibrant network of cities around the world who are exemplary in the fields of literature, music, art, film, folk art. And we lose that, but we also lose having a seat at the table. By not paying our dues, those funds were backstopped by countries like China and Qatar, who then were able to exert more leverage, more influence over this body, which is dedicated in the first instance to free expression. So we now have the case of authoritarian regimes wielding more influence at UNESCO than we do. And remember, this is the place that also safeguards the oceans. The early warning tsunami system is a product of UNESCO. And those kinds of activities, not to mention World Heritage sites, intangible heritage, on and on and on, we lose our part in that discussion.
Quickly before we go, Chris, what does this mean for Iowa City as the only UNESCO-designated city of literature in our country?
Well, at the moment, it's a little unclear. We don't formally withdraw from UNESCO till the end of 2018, and we think that the designation will hold. But there are other cities in the pipeline trying to become UNESCO cities of literature and design in this country, and one would imagine that UNESCO will not look favorably on those applications. So once again, we shoot ourselves in the feet.
Christopher Merrill, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, also serves on the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO. Thanks for coming in, Chris.
Thank you, Ben.
And finally today on this News Buzz edition, since the end of August, 35 writers from 34 countries have made a temporary home in Iowa City as part of a 12-week writer's residency put on by the International Writing Program. Now, back in August, just a few days after they arrived, I attended a welcoming party for them and talked briefly with a half dozen or so of the writers. Today, let's meet a visiting writer from Southern Africa.
Hi, my name is Panache Chigumadze. I was born in Zimbabwe and I grew up in South Africa. I write nonfiction as well as fiction. I'm currently working on a book of essays called Beautiful Hair for a Landless People. And that's on the interwoven politics of hair and land in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to the United States before?
I have. I have been to the United States before. This is my fourth time, I think, in the United States. The first time was on holiday to Disney World, so it was fun.
and to Iowa, is this your first time?
No, so this is my first time in the Midwest. So I've been to New York before twice. And yeah, that's a very different experience coming to Midwest America, particularly at this point in America's history. So that's also an interesting experience.
Right, it must be very interesting for you as a writer to come here at, as you say, this point in our history. What interests you most, coming from South Africa to the United States?
Yeah. I'll be very honest. I think that I'm very conscious of myself in this body, right? So I'm still unsure of myself in the sense of I don't know necessarily what's the best way to conduct myself because I'm not really sure who it is that I'm dealing with. I don't know about police. I don't know about a whole range of things.
We're on the radio, so yeah. your appearance, describe your appearance and why you think that's a problem. I mean,
okay. So I am I'm black, which means I'm relatively dark. I have short hair, which is also a popular style in South Africa, which is not really something that people do here. So it's, we'd call it a fade. I have a fade hairstyle. I am relatively, I have wide shoulders. So in the sense that I'm not a small person, if I put it that way. So I'm aware of sort of being read as looking aggressive in some way. Sometimes I can look quite so-called masculine presenting, depending on the day that you catch me. And so sometimes, I forget, I just dress how I feel like dressing in the morning. And then I walk out in the street. I'm like, oh snap, maybe you shouldn't have worn that hoodie. Oh snap, you shouldn't have done this and this kind of thing. So I'm just aware of, I think I'm a generally courteous person, but I think I'm a lot more aware of being polite. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone cuts in front of me in front of the queue. I'm aware of sort of, I don't want to start something because I don't know where this could end
right,
up.
Right, right. And yeah. You're getting this impression that you have to be more cautious because of what's happening here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, of course, like we follow, particularly South Africa shares a lot of the sort of, it's almost the inverse of our racial history here, but sort of I think South Africans more than other groups of Africans understand sort of race relations a lot more. And so we follow a lot what's happening here. I mean, we've been part of a lot of hours on the university campuses, so there have been a lot of student protests. You'll find that movements around sort of changing names, particularly around those who've had like sort of slave histories, came from, or they had a lot of the inspiration from what was happening with the student movements in South Africa. So there's a lot of that long history, not just right now, but historically between sort of African Americans and black South Africans. So I'm always aware of sort of what are African Americans writing about being in different spaces. And of course, Iowa cities are different because it's liberal in a relatively conservative state. And so it's just a weird experience because you're wondering who goes to the Ku Klux Klan rally and who doesn't, because it's not like people are walking around sort of with hoods or whatever. So you don't know who you're dealing with. So for example, in the plane, there was a sort of very Midwestern-y looking man, if I put it that way, but he was really nice and he was like really, really polite and that sort of thing, and he made a lot more effort to, you know, have conversation. So that kind of put me at ease. Like, okay.
So your anxiety, at least in the first few days here, is being put at ease?
Yeah, I think it's more, I mean, as long as I'm sort of with the community, but I am aware about, for example, the other day I went to the gym and I've been very aware of, like, I want to take a run, but I need to first make sure that I clear it with other people. Like, is it okay for me to run? If I'm going to run, what should I wear when I do that? What time should I go? I can't just go at any, you know, period. So I remember walking and I saw the police van and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to cry if I, you know, get stopped, because I don't know. Because I mean, my experience with police in South Africa is very different. For example, it's just a very different environment. So because it's not my space, it's just getting used to what are the protocols, how do you engage and how do you interact. So I think if I can get my bearings around what to do and how to be cool, I think I'll be fine in some time. But it's just in this particular moment, in a way that I haven't felt before when I've come to the States. I think it's this particular moment where I think we've always known America is the history and sort of anti-blackness and white supremacy from sort of the founding days. But it's a very different thing where you're seeing rallies and people sort of being emboldened in that. So that's what you're just sort of aware of. It's, you don't really know. You just kind of feel like, okay, you don't want to be caught unawares in the wrong place at the wrong time and that kind of thing. So that's just, yeah, yeah.
Briefly, what is here? What do you see here when you put in yourself in the writer's mode?
Yeah.
What do you want to accomplish in the 12 weeks?
So much. I want to finish a manuscript, a couple of manuscripts I want to finish, but I think more than anything, I would like to just immerse myself right now in the experience. I think in as much as America can be a very scary place right now, I also think it's a very interesting space, and I think it's also productive. I think there is ways in which this moment right now is also productive in the sense that We have to deal with the things. It's not really something that's underneath the bubble. So I'm looking forward to just observing what this is like here. Also with the other writers, which is also really great, speaking to, it's interesting hearing about writers speaking about identity and what that means for them in their context. You know, people from Palestine, people from Mexico, people from Hungary. And that's also really good because sometimes, I think particularly given what's happening right now, It's easy to remain in my silo, so it's easy for me to be focused on, okay, this is what it is to be a black body in the States right now. But then I'm seeing that there's so many other people who might be sort of white-looking but have completely different backgrounds, and they speak about fascism, they speak about communism and all kinds of things. So I guess it's also one way that, on one hand, I'm really focused on what it is to be me right now, but at the same time, I'm also focused on what it is to be other kinds of people from across the world, which is also a really good experience to have at the same time. Yeah.
We wish you all the best in your stay here in Iowa. Thank you for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank
we
you
appreciate
very much.
It.
Thank you. And I listen to a lot of public radio from America, which is really funny. So, like, I do Ira Glass's voice as well. And
you do that?
Okay, it's not great. I mean, you just heard it. It's not a great accent.
Let me hear your Ira Glass.
Hi, this is Ira Glass. And there's Jad Abumrad, Glenn Washington. Like, I listen to. I listen to quite a bit of it. Sometimes I just need to zone out sometimes, so I just listen to quite a bit.
From South Africa.
Yeah.
You have an influence of public radio in the United States.
Yeah, because you know there's public radio voice and all those different debates. So, yeah, we listen to quite a bit of a podcast here. But we're building a podcast culture that's as well. But, yeah, the thing in my mind is always sort of just like the, hi, this is Ira Glass, and oh, this is Test, this is Radio Lab, this is me, Jad Abumrad, with Robert Krulwich, and all of that sort of thing. So yeah, that's a little trivia about me, yeah.
Getting to know a few of the 35 writers from 34 countries who've come to Iowa for this year's International Writing Program Fall Residency. That's it for today. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.